Welcome to World Ocean Radio. I'm Peter Neal, director of the World Ocean Observatory, and we're talking today with Irene Kinnan Kelly, a biologist of the Western Pacific Regional Fisheries Management Council in Honolulu, Hawaii, about sea turtles. Irene, there are seven species of sea turtles that grace our oceans, six of them in the Pacific. They evolved 110 million years ago, and yet they remain very much part of our lives. And I think the public is genuinely fascinated with these marvelous creatures. Let's talk about the condition of these species worldwide, and what's going on to understand them and conserve them.
Aloha. Thank you, Peter, for the opportunity to chat with you today. Yes, in the Pacific, we do have six species of sea turtles. We've got the hard-shelled turtles, which are loggerheads, olive ridleys, green sea turtles, and hawksbills, and as well as the flatback, but this turtle only occurs in Australian waters, and the leatherback, which is not characterized as a hard-shelled turtle, but more of a soft-shell, sort of rubbery-skinned turtle, but the largest of species of all the sea turtles, growing to about 1,500 pounds or 2 tons, quite a large animal. Many of the species, as we know, are in critical conditions, especially the loggerhead and the leatherback, and perhaps also the hawksbill turtle in the Pacific. The other species, olive ridleys, greens, are doing quite well in some instances. Some populations are quite stable. But like I said, the leatherback and the loggerhead are the two species that we are most concerned of at the moment. There's numerous programs throughout the world that have sprouted over these last few years to try to address these issues, both from a biology standpoint and also from a conservation and fishery management standpoint. So this involves hundreds, perhaps thousands of people on the ground working with communities and with governments and with NGOs to coordinate efforts and make some real positive things happen.
Let's talk first about the migration patterns, the range of these animals, and how we are tracking them and learning about that aspect of their lives.
Well, the really interesting thing about sea turtles is that they're global migrators. They're ocean ambassadors of the ocean, I guess you can call them, connecting cultures and countries throughout the Pacific. The North Pacific loggerhead, for example, nests in Japan, and then the hatchlings enter the water and migrate across the Pacific through the central North Pacific to Baja California, Mexico, where they grow and develop for 15 to 20 years and then embark on their return migration back to Japan to nest. And that trans-Pacific migration can last up to 30 years. Loggerheads aren't mature to re-nest again until they're 30 to 35 years of age. So, which puts them, you can imagine the threats that puts them under, both environmental threats and human-related threats, both from fisheries and other issues.
So they have this long ocean passage. What are the threats there, the fisheries threats, both direct and indirect?
Well, during their long migration, they do migrate through the high seas and the exclusive economic zones of many, many nations. Longline fisheries are a problem for them, and then when they get into the coastal areas, they have greater impacts from gillnet fisheries and trawl fisheries, as well as direct harvest from people who have had a long-standing relationship with turtles and have harvested them for many, many centuries. But yet now, when we have reduced population sizes, that impact gets to be stronger. So their threats are pretty wide and wide-ranging, and each impact has a its own specific way to address it. And
so one interaction takes place with fishermen. And how is that changing the open sea fishery?
Well, let's see. Fishermen and fisheries, longline fisheries, have become very proactive over these last, I'd say, 5 to 10 years. We've begun to identify some really useful mitigation measures that fishermen can use. The Hawaii-based longline fleet is probably one of the most environmentally proactive fleets in the Pacific. And using circle hooks and mackerel bait, we have found really works phenomenally well to reduce interaction rates with longline gear and turtles. So we work pretty hard to transfer these measures to other international fleets. We work closely with the Japanese and the Taiwanese fleets and many of the Latin American fleets involved in experimental work to see if these measures will work for them in their fleets. Each fleet, each fishery has its own characteristics, and so it's not a one measure works for everything. You have to kind of tailor things to each fleet. But you see a lot of groups and fishermen and fisheries beginning to become more active and involved in sea turtle mitigation measures.
I've noticed two things about the longline fishery. One is the change in the shape of the hook, and the second is the level of at which the hooks are set below the sort of turtle layer, which is more toward the surface. But when I look at the hooks, I find the change so amazingly subtle. And I'm very curious as to know how that evolved. How did we go from one hook to another where the shape change and the barb configuration seems not that different one from another?
Well, this is a sort of a development the fishermen themselves actually came up with, making the hook change shape from the traditional J-shaped hook to a more circle-shaped hook where the shaft is pointed inward. And so if you can think about it, if an animal bites on a circled shape hook, the chances of it hooking on the lower jaw is a lot greater than it hooking in the roof of the mouth, which was where some of the problems were with the J-shaped hook. And as well as a larger shaped circle hook will also not be swallowed as easily. So using a large shaped circle hook, it's kind of a tongue twister, actually really does reduce interaction rates, and it also reduces the severity of interactions. So even though a turtle may be hooked, they're hooked in a less lethal place, and they don't swallow the hook, and the hook can be removed, and then the turtle can be let go. The difference between shallow sets and deep sets is that we have found that shallow sets catch more turtles than deep set fisheries, because mostly turtles are found in that top 40 meters of the water. And so this is more important for shallow set fisheries that target swordfish to use circle hooks so that they can both reduce their impact on catching turtles.
So as the turtles approach the shoreline, what happens then? What become the threats just offshore, coastwise, and once they come to the beach?
Okay, well, up till now, we've been talking about pelagic open ocean fisheries. In nearshore fisheries, you have artisanal fisheries that are hard to explain and describe because they're mostly not so uniform. They're mostly a fisherman going out and fishing, usually subsistence-type fishing for their families and their communities. It's anyone's guess how many artisanal fisheries there are and how many artisanal fishermen there are. So there are longline artisanal fisheries, there are gillnet fisheries, there are commercial trawl fisheries. And so as a turtle moves into a coastal environment, their chances for interacting with fisheries even become greater because there's just more people, more activity going on in the coastal areas.
What about debris? What about the kinds of material things that are floating in the ocean, plastic, bags, other kinds of debris that they encounter en route?
Well, undeniably, plastic is a big problem, not just for sea turtles, but for all critters in the ocean, definitely. Sea turtles do eat jellyfish. Leatherback turtles eat jellyfish. And we know that a plastic bag looks a lot like a jellyfish in the water. Entanglements of plastics and in derelict gear is a severe problem for turtles. And, you know, it's hard to put a number on it. It's hard to say how many turtles a year are impacted. Because you may not see those impacts on the beach. You know, a turtle that dies at sea may sink and you never see it again. So it's hard to put a number on it, but other than to say that impacts are expected to be high and quite severe.
So now the turtle has made this incredible voyage, arrives on the beach, and the most important part now takes place, which is the laying of the eggs and sort of the propagation of the turtle population for the future. What happens then?
Well, I guess that's where things really get interesting. A female turtle will nest up to 4 to 8 times during a season, which means she'll come up, nest, go back to the ocean for about 1 to 2 weeks, and then re-emerge and lay another clutch of eggs, about 100 eggs or so in every clutch. Mama turtle leaves, and she leaves her eggs in the sand to incubate, and in about 2 months, baby hatchlings emerge. So now in a perfect world, of course, these nests would be allowed to hatch. There would be some predation, of course, of foxes or crabs or birds as the hatchlings were rushing to the sea. And then, of course, once they're in the water, there are fish and sharks and jacks that would, you know, take advantage of the hatchlings in the water. So it's quite an arduous journey for a little hatchling to make it out to the pelagic ocean where it's much safer for them. In modern day, we have a lot more issues on the beach. We've got development, we have hotels and people living on beaches, and light pollution is intense in some places. It disorients hatchlings and sends them the wrong direction, not out to sea, but more towards the light, which is probably inland at a house somewhere or a hotel. Because of our development practices, we've changed beach structures around. Sand doesn't really settle the way it used to. Beaches have eroded, so there's less beach available for turtles to nest on. And then, of course, when they're on the beach, that's when they become threatened with predation, usually by humans, either taking adult females that are coming ashore to nest, or the eggs themselves, which have both turtles and eggs are a culturally important component of many coastal communities. And so all of these impacts together really take the toll over time.
What can be done to protect them?
Well, on the beach, one thing that can be done is to not eat turtles or turtle eggs, at least for a while, until we can better understand what the population is doing. Other things that can happen is if a nest is laid below the low tide mark where it will be washed away, or if it's laid in an area which will erode away. Many scientists and biologists now are relocating nests, putting them up higher up on the beach to a safer location. Of course, there are very strict conditions that has to occur. You have to handle the nest properly and the eggs properly, or the eggs aren't viable. And then there's other things that can happen because you've got predation, sometimes dogs. In some places, we found that dog predation is very severe in some places, and other places, pig predation is very severe. So you have different measures that you can use to try to address dog and pig predation to save those hatchlings, because what you really want are hatchlings going into the water.
So scientists are now working to understand these systems better. What questions are they asking? What are the priority questions that they're asking? And what techniques are they using to answer those questions?
I think one of the high priority questions are what are the stocks? If you look at the ocean, you have turtles everywhere, but are they all one stock? Do they all belong to one place? A turtle will come back to the nesting beach where it was hatched and where its mom laid the egg. When this hatchling leaves that beach and goes out to sea, she will return 30 years later to that same beach. And so the idea is to try to identify what stocks turtles belong to and how best to manage those stocks. And one tool that scientists are using is genetic research to try to identify the genetic fingerprint of turtles. For example, in Hawaii, we have a genetically distinct Hawaiian green sea turtle. We know that now, separate genetically from the other green turtle in the Pacific. Another tool that scientists are using is satellite telemetry, where you actually put a telemetry device on a turtle and you let it go and you watch where it goes. And they're different kinds. Some last longer than others. Just depends on the type of research you're doing. If you want to understand what the animal's doing at that immediate vicinity, you know, you have one type of tag, or if you have a tag, if you want to know information about cross-country migration stuff, you have a different type of tag. So tag recapture stuff is also very important. Just tagging a turtle and seeing where the tag is recaptured, where that animal is recaptured, gives you a lot of migratory information and habitat use information.
Indigenous people revere the turtle. The turtle finds itself in art, song, mythology. It always has confused me how there is this reverence on the one hand, and what many Westerners perceive to be an indifference on the other. And yet when you talk to indigenous peoples here in Hawaii, it's very clear to them their relationship between these, between their needs and the needs of the animals and their reverence for the animals. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I don't know if it's fair to say that Westerners have, you know, very little regard for turtles. I'm not an indigenous person, and I seem to care a little bit. I think lots of people care.
Well, actually, I held a fledgling yesterday in my hands and barely could keep back the tears. I almost fell apart, so I'm with you on that completely.
I think indigenous cultures throughout the world, any coastal society has had a very close connection with the sea turtle. I don't know what it is. There's some spiritual connection that people feel that they have with turtles. Turtles have this symbol of longevity. They do live for 30 to 60, perhaps 100 years. They have this stamina of they will survive for long periods of time without food. And then when conditions are right, they will, again, begin to grow again. So they have this way of really controlling their physiology to match their current conditions, which is really interesting. And I think people, indigenous cultures that were once very much in tune with their surroundings and their environment, really appreciated the turtle and its role it had in its environment as well.
In the context of conservation, what have been the successes?
One of the most striking successes that we have here in Hawaii, for example, is the Hawaiian green sea turtle, the recovery of the Hawaiian green sea turtle. Over 35 plus years of research, the combined commitment of scientists such as people like George Balazs, community members, fishermen, conservationists, NGOs, management agencies throughout Hawaii over the last 30 plus years have really begun to now show us that we have a recovering green sea turtle population here in Hawaii. Those of you who have visited Hawaii and entered the waters, you'll see evidence of this, where there seem to be turtles everywhere nowadays. Back in the early 70s, we began to realize that the numbers were quite low. This was a result of intense harvest during the 50s and 60s, mostly for local markets here. Tourism had begun to spike up and increase here, and people wanted green sea turtle steaks in their restaurants. And so as a response to this, there was some severe over-harvesting of the green turtle. Management efforts in the early 70s, mid-70s started, and it was that combined commitment of all the people I mentioned that have now resulted in what we have to be recovering trends. The reduction of nesting beach impacts and the reduction and elimination of foraging ground harvest has really shown us that conservation can happen and recovery can happen, definitely. Which reminds me to mention that long-term commitments here are necessary. You have to really put in the time, put in the energy before you'll really start to see things happen. In this case, 30 plus years. So that's another factor that contributes to the problems that turtles face is that need for that long-term commitment, both of energy, resources, personnel, and local buy-in from the communities as well.
Are there organizations where people can go and follow these migrations, for example, on the web?
There are a number of places where one can go to get more information on sea turtles, such as seaturtle.org. That's an excellent website where you can contact all sorts of people involved in sea turtle conservation and research. And you can become part of that listserv as well. And so that's a really interesting and great resource. Also, one can go to the National Marine Fisheries Service website for protected species. Lots of information there as well as publications. You can go to the council's website, wpcouncil.org. Contact us, and we can send you all sorts of information. We've currently and recently just published a document that highlights our collective projects in the Pacific, over 50 plus projects, if anyone's interested in what those are. And then another actually interesting resource for green sea turtles in Hawaii is turtletracks.com. That's turtle, T-R-A-X.com. A really great resource for green sea turtles in Hawaii. Brings you through that long-term commitment I was talking about of hatchlings first leaving the water back in 1974 and now just 35 plus years later being to think about returning to that nesting beach to nest. And so there's a long history there of information, lots of pictures, lots of great info of the people involved in conservation. So if you're interested, feel free Again, you can contact us at wpcouncil.org if you need more information.
So I'm a young person listening to this radio broadcast, and I'm excited about this, and I want to get involved. I want to become a marine scientist. What road do I travel?
Well, I guess there's many different roads to travel. I guess it just depends on what your interest is, how dirty you want to get your hands. I started off as a biologist and working in the field with animals in remote locations, and then eventually migrated into a more management type position because I wanted to build that bridge between management and the environment and what was really going on. Try to increase some understanding in policymakers and decision makers. But yeah, there's biology, geography, physiology, all sorts of different ways that people can get involved.
All of this seems like it's a long, long way from me as I sit here listening to this interview. I'm not a young person, but I still want to be involved. How can I help?
Well, of course, we've heard this many, many times before, but of course, reducing marine debris and reducing your impacts on the ocean in terms of making sure we recycle, making sure the plastics don't get into the sea is a number one way that people can help. You can help by selecting people that are more green and pro-environment and want to find alternative means of energy and of ways of thinking about how we extract our resources. And we can, and involved in that as well has to do with education is huge. Getting education and information out to school groups and to kids on the beaches that live in more out of the way indigenous places is important, and it's a challenge to do that, but I think that's really one of the biggest things that people can do is help to share the knowledge.
Thank you, Irene. It's a wonderful interview, and I really appreciate your time. We've been talking with Irene Kinnan-Kelly, a biologist with the Western Pacific Regional Fisheries Management Council in Honolulu, Hawaii. This is World Ocean Radio, a program of the World Ocean Observatory, a forum for information and educational services about the ocean, online at www.thew2o.net. That's online at www.thew2o.net.